So when I was in high school way back in the day, I was lucky enough to get a job as a disc jockey at a radio station. And one of the responsibilities I had for myself was I had to do play-by-play of regional high school basketball games. It's my senior year of high school. It's a Christmas season. I'm calling the first game of a doubleheader. Somebody else is calling the last game of the night because I've got to sign the radio station on the air the next morning at 6 a.m. So I borrow my dad's car, a green 1966 Chevrolet Bel Air, and now you know the time period I'm talking about. I pick up my best friend Gary, and we head off to the western end of the county, and I call my game. My game's over, and I head back to my car to drive home, and my car is now blocked on three sides by cars that have arrived for the second game. On the fourth side, it's blocked by this portable cement mixer. I'm thinking, I'm going to be stuck here till like midnight, then I got to drive home, then I got to get up at 5 to sign the station on the air. And then I kept looking, and I thought, you know, if I drive really carefully, I think I can get out of here. So I positioned Gary outside the car, had him moving from side to side. I'm moving the wheel back and forth, and finally, I am free of all three of the other cars. And knowing that I'm free, I put my foot on the gas, and I hear this ominous thud. Caught the front left fender of Dad's green 66 Chevrolet Bel Air on the trailer hitch of the portable cement mixer. Gary went around to that side of the car. I rolled down the window. I said, "So, Gary, do you think my dad will notice?" He said, "Yeah, Paul, unless your dad's become blind in the last 3 hours, he'll be noticing." And I got out, and sure enough, there it was, a softball-sized, well, really more like a volleyball-sized dent in the front left fender of Dad's green Chevy Bel Air. I drove home that night. It was late. It was dark. I went to bed. I got up early the next morning, went to the radio station, came home at noon, and parked Dad's car way, way back behind the garage, distancing myself from my offense. Dad came in the middle of the afternoon, said, "I need the keys," and he went out to do some errands. And then he came back home, and I waited for the inquisition to begin. "So, Paul, is there anything you want to tell me?" But when he comes back in the house, he says not a word, nothing, not a single word. He takes Mom out to dinner that night, comes home. I wait for the questioning to begin. Again, not a single question. But then it occurred to me, it's Saturday. My father is a pastor. He's waiting until Sunday. He wants guilt to have its greatest impact. Sunday morning came. I'm looking at him. He says nothing. After church, we all go to lunch together in the car. Still not a word from Dad. Like the next 2 weeks, every day as I'm coming home from school, I'm thinking, this is the day. Every day, not a word. Not a single word. Well, about 3 weeks later, I came home and the dent was gone. No longer there. Still not a single word from Dad. It's now like 40 years later, and I'm not sure, but I'm starting to come to the conclusion that Dad is not ever going to talk to me about that dent in the front left fender of his green 66 Chevrolet Bel Air. I think my father has chosen to be gracious toward the younger of his two sons. Wouldn't be the first time father had chosen to be gracious toward the younger of his two sons. It's the most famous story Jesus ever told. 15th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, the third of three stories on lostness. It's a story about a father who had two sons. Now, the younger of these sons decided it was time for him to separate himself from home and head off out on his own into the world. And this is, in fact, typical adolescent behavior. I mean, kids hit their teen years and they recognize it's time for them to separate themselves from home. And generally, one of three different things occurs. Sometimes we find it impossible to separate ourselves from our family of origin. So you see, some people who remain enmeshed with their family of origin, they really are not ever able to separate themselves from mom and dad. You know you're in this category if you're like maybe 40 years of age and you still are afraid to disagree with your parents about anything. Often in these kind of families, you'll have a controlling matriarch or patriarch, think the mother from Everybody Loves Raymond. In this first category, people are just not able to separate themselves from their family of origin. I always find it ironic that these families are so screwed up, but think about it. You grow up in a screwed-up family, and you're convinced, therefore, hey, if our family's screwed up, the entire world must be screwed up, so better the devil I know than the devil I don't know. So we stay enmeshed in that family of origin. That's one thing that might happen when you hit those teen years. Now, a second extreme that often happens is what we call emotional cutoff. That's when you completely separate yourself from your family and have nothing to do with them. This guy I've been working with in Long Island for like 20 years, he's been telling me for 20 years that his mother died when he was 18. And just last Christmas time, I found out his mother is still alive, suffering from schizophrenia in a mental hospital on Long Island. That would be emotional cutoff, totally separating yourself from your family. And ironically, if you do that, your family is still controlling you. They're just controlling you in absentia. Most of us, though, actually are able to separate from our families, not at either one of those extremes. We kind of take a middle path. We hit the teen years. We realize we're going to have to step out on our own. And so we begin to separate ourselves from mom and dad. And boys and girls do it in very, very different ways. Boys use what we call the flight syndrome. They turn 17, get their driver's license, and they just leave. They bodily leave the house and only come back for food, money, and laundry. That's it. They're physically gone. They use the flight syndrome. Girls don't do it that way. No, girls, you see, they recognize the same need to separate from mom and dad, but they stay in the house and they separate verbally. We call it the fight syndrome. My wife and I raised two teenage daughters. Those were marvelous years from around 13 to 19. We were the stupidest people on the face of the earth. It's, you know, if you've had a teenage daughter, you know exactly, or been one, you know what I'm talking about. But as difficult as those years are, most of the time our children don't want to see us dead. I say most of the time because evidently that was not the case in this particular story. The younger of the two sons goes to his father and asks for the one-third of the family inheritance that will properly be his, in their culture as in ours, when his father died. So when he asks for his inheritance ahead of time, he's basically saying to his father, I wish you were dead. For whatever reason, Jesus doesn't tell us, the father decides to go ahead and give his younger son the one-third of the family inheritance that would eventually be his. And the younger son promptly takes that money and heads off and attends a party university somewhere in Florida where he drinks away his freshman year. You know this story. Takes 6 years to get a bachelor's degree in general studies. What's he going to do with that? Now he's graduated, he cannot find a job anywhere, so he ends up spending the rest of the family money, and then he's absolutely broke and penniless and hungry and starving, and he goes back to the only thing he knows, farming. He gets a job feeding pigs. Now, the way they fed pigs in that day was to actually go into the field and climb up into trees, and they would shake carob tree limbs, and so the carob pods would fall to the ground, and the pigs would eat the carob pods. So here this poor guy is, in the middle of a field, sitting in a tree, shaking limbs, watching the carob pods fall to the ground, wishing that he could eat the food the pigs are eating, and Jesus says, he came to his senses. I love that phrase. He came to his senses. Have you ever had that moment where you come to your senses? A whole bunch of years ago, not really that young, and you've already had that experience. Amazing. A whole bunch of years ago, I was headed from LaGuardia out to Akron, Ohio, where I spent part of my growing up years. And I was going to my home church. I hadn't seen those people in forever. I was going to speak the next day. It was one of those really crappy days here in New York. I was on a CRJ 200, which if you fly a lot, is in fact the airline version of a clown car. 50 seats in that thing, it should be like 12. It's a horrible, horrible piece of equipment. So, of course, we're on the tarmac at LaGuardia for like 2.5 hours because the weather's crappy. And when I finally get to Ohio, it's late and I'm in a bad mood and I get to the hotel. And the woman behind the counter, it's much too cheery for that late at night. And she said, well, nice to have you here. Glad you're here. Yeah, whatever. I just said, Williams non-smoking. This is long enough ago that they still had smoking rooms. Very cheerily, she says, well, Mr. Williams, you're in 1321. I still remember the room, unfortunately. So I go to my room, I open the door, and I am blown backwards by the smell of smoke. I walk into the room, and there's ashtrays. And so I march back into the manager's office there, the lobby, and I said, that would be a smoking room. She fiddles with her computer, and then with a big grin, she says, well, it's listed here as non-smoking. Well, I've been living in New York for 39 years now, so, you know, I can get sarcastic when I need to. And so I I said, hey, you know, whenever I smell a decidedly smoky odor and I see ashtrays, I tend to think that that is, whatever you say, notwithstanding, a smoking room. She fiddles with the computer again, then she looks up, still grinning, said, I'm sorry, we don't have any more non-smoking rooms. And so now, kind of mocking her, I'm sorry, I'm going to another hotel. And I left without another word. I mean, slept not well, get up the next morning, today's got to be better. Go to the church that I haven't been to in 20 years. I see these people. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. I'm having a great time. The worship is terrific, just like the worship's been all weekend. I really like the worship team. And so it's great. And I'm looking forward to preaching. And I stand up to preach. And there she is on the second row. The clerk from the Smoky Hotel. And trust me, folks, I came to my senses. As soon as the service was over, I made a beeline toward her. I said, so the guy last night, he just seemed really, really tired or maybe more like mean. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but I'd say way more inside of mean. We talked about what it means to be human, to be in a bad mood, talked about what it means to treat people with dignity even when you had a tough day. Turns out I'd known her parents since I was like 10. I mean, it was truly embarrassing. It's a tough thing to have to come to your senses. It's even harder when it's a more serious offense, when your family comes to you and says, you've got a problem with alcohol, and either you go into treatment or you start AA or we're out of here. It's hard to have to come to your senses, to have your family come to you and say, you've been much too depressed for much too long and we're tired of taking the brunt of it, you need to get some help. Or to have your coworkers come to you and say, dude, really, get a life, go home, what are you doing? This is not your life. It's a tough thing to have to come to your senses. Jesus tells us the young man came to his senses, and note the major sense to which he came was hunger. He's hungry. He's starving. So he puts together a plan. He's going to go back home and tell his father how sorry he is. He knows he has squandered the family fortune, that he can't be a son again. He's given up his birthright, but hey, his dad can at least give him a job and he'll have a roof over his head. Is he sorry for what he's done? Interestingly, Jesus doesn't tell us. We don't know. All we know is that he's hungry. So he heads back home, bangs on the door, bangs on the door, bangs on the door, begs his father to let him in the house, and the father looks at the servants and says, he's back. You think he's suffered enough, or should we let him suffer some more before we let him in? I don't know. What do you think? Is that what the father does? This is basically how I understood this story as a kid. It's a story of a son who finally comes to see the error of his ways. And he heads back home and begs and begs and begs his father, please let me in. And the father, against his better judgment, finally forgives him. Only problem is that's actually not how the story goes. The son heads back home, and when he is still a long way from the house, the father sees him. The father sees him a long way from the house because he's been out looking for him the whole time. Important point. The father never stopped looking for the son. And when he sees his son, he starts running toward him. Now, if I have squandered my family's fortune on loose living, and I'm headed back home and I see my father running toward me, there's a real good chance I'm going to turn around and run the other way. You too, right? The father catches up with him, and the son starts into his spiel. I've sinned against you, and the father will hear nothing of it. He says to his servants, go and bring a ring, sandals, and a robe. In that culture, signs of sonship, honor, and power. And he said, and kill the fatted calf, because we're going to have to celebrate, because my son who was lost has been found, and we must celebrate. Now note, we still don't know if this kid's sorry or not. Jesus hasn't told us that. All we know is he's hungry. But now we're beginning to understand this is, in fact, not a story about the younger son at all. Most Bibles will say the story of the prodigal son above this section. That's not what it's about. It's not about the younger son. It's about something else. Enter the older brother. Now, the older brother has stayed at home all along, keeping the rules. Typical oldest child, wanting to make sure he does everything just right. He pays his taxes on time. He's never murdered anybody. Trying to make things go at the farm, even though now he's got one-third less farmland to deal with since his kid brother took off with part of the inheritance. So he's been out working hard in the fields. He heads back home, got his own servants with him. He sees something going on at the house. Looks a little weird. He sends his servants down to the house. The servants come back and say, yeah, well, actually, your kid brother came home, and your dad killed the fatted calf, and they're having this huge party, and he wants you to come in and celebrate. And the older son refuses to go and eat with his father. Now, refusing to eat with your father in our culture would be something that's kind of tacky, would probably indicate you're not getting along with your father real well, but that's really all it would mean. In that culture, to refuse to eat with your father was unheard of. It was grounds for being disowned as a child. No one would refuse to eat with a father. So he refuses to go in and eat with his father. When the father hears this, what does he do? Does the father sit in the house and say, oh, that older kid, he always sees the glass half empty. Just leave him there. You know, Garrison Keillor has a name for those kinds of people. He calls them the dark Lutherans. You know who they are, the people who always see things negatively. So the father sits in the house and says, yeah, you know, just leave him out there. Let him get over it. He'll eventually come back. Is that what the father does? No. No, the father goes out to this older son who has so incredibly wronged him. Now, we don't know if the younger son was truly sorry or not. Jesus doesn't tell us. But note, there's not 1 ounce of sorrow, not 1 ounce of it in the older son. And yet still, the father goes out to him. And when he gets there, what happens? The older son blasts the father. Hey, I have worked my finger to the bone trying to make this farm work. I don't get so much as a goat. My kid brother squanders a family fortune, comes back home, and you kill the fatted calf. What's wrong with this story? And the father says, oh, everything I have is yours. It's always been yours. It always will be yours. But your brother was lost and has been found, and we must celebrate. And we think to ourselves, gee, that's not very fair. Excellent. Very good. It's not fair. Somewhere along the line, we got the idea that religion was about keeping rules, following regulations, believing the right thing, about being fair. And we Americans tend to be very religious people at our core. We want justice. American justice. We know what justice is. It's giving people what they deserve. You do the crime, you do the time. Well, this is, in fact, a story Jesus told about justice, but it's not about American justice. There was a Hebrew word for justice, the word tzedak. And it was not a word that meant giving people what they deserve. It was a word that meant giving people what God wants them to have. Whole different understanding of justice. And now we begin to understand this is not a story about a younger son who sees the error of his ways, repents, and returns back to the father. It's not a story about that. It's not a story about a nice religious older son who stays at home and keeps the rules. It's not a story about either son at all. Let's be honest, they were both really jerks. It's a story about a father. It's a story about a father who loves no matter what. Because it's what the father does. It's who the father is. You know, you've been in a series here over the last several weeks about change. And I really think it's time that we change our understanding of God. Much too much we see God as this angry judge sitting in heaven. And in reality, he is this father who refuses to stop loving. No matter what. It is outrageous, his love. You can't be so bad. He does and still love you. It's the most outrageous story ever told in the history of mankind. We have a God who loves no matter what. You know, every Christmas Eve, we work at the Orchard Group office. For a long time, our office was on Long Island. We've just moved it into Manhattan up by the Flatirons building. But on Long Island, we always worked until noon on Christmas Eve. Now, there was one major reason for this. Our bookkeeper's mother made these incredible Italian cookies, and she didn't make them until the night before. So if we didn't work Christmas Eve day, I was never going to get the cookies. So we always worked till noon on Christmas Eve day. And so a few years ago, she not only makes these cookies for all of us, but she also makes this Christmas cake, a bundt cake, you know, round cake, hole in the middle. And so bring it to the office, and I take just a little tiny bite of the cake, and it's really incredible. And so I took it home, and I told Kathy, I said, you know, you got to take a taste of this. And she took a little tiny taste, and she said, oh, this is dessert, Christmas dessert. This is incredible. So, you know, we enjoyed Christmas Eve, went to church, then came back and did our regular Christmas routine with the kids, and then the kids went to bed. Kathy and I started wrapping Christmas presents. It's about midnight. We decided to go to bed. Last thing I did was take some plastic, cover over that cake, and then put it on top of a container, a Tupperware, push it to the back of the kitchen counter. Kathy comes to bed. We go to sleep. She gets up about 6 in the morning, goes downstairs, comes back to the bedroom, and said, Paul, we have a bit of a problem. I said, what happened? She said, well, Lily, our golden retriever, has eaten the entire Christmas bundt cake. I said, the whole thing? She said, oh, yeah, the whole thing. In fact, she's taken the plate and pushed it under the refrigerator, trying to hide the evidence. I went downstairs, and Lily had already been banished out the back door, one of those really cold Christmas mornings. She was leaning against the glass of the back door, shivering. You ever seen a dog? I had never seen a dog shiver before. She is shivering. I had not 1 ounce of sorry for her in my bones. Not at all. It's not a bit. I went over, looked at her through the window, and said, of course you're shivering. That's because every ounce of energy you've got that could be warming your extremities is instead digesting my bundt cake. I left her there, shivering. Kids got up, came down, ran through the kitchen, going to go into the family room to open their presents. Well, they ran through the kitchen. They see a dog shivering out the door. How can you open presents when there's a shivering dog? So they opened the door, brought her in, took her up to Jaina's room. Jaina's my youngest, and they all hopped in bed with her, with the dog in the middle. Now, you got to understand, my kids were in college at the time. They're like 18 to 22. So here all three of them are in bed with the dog in between them, the covers pulled up to the dog's chin, and that dog with the biggest doggy grin you've ever seen in your life. She ate the Christmas bundt cake. And here she was receiving all the love my three kids had to give. Well, here's the truth, folks. I have eaten the Christmas bundt cake. And I've lived long enough now to realize I am going to eat it over and over and over again. You are too. But there's good news. We have a God who loves us anyway. And he brings us in from the shivering cold and warms us in his blankets and gives us all the love he has to give. And if you understand that, well, then you understand the story of a father who had two sons. Will you pray with me? Father, I thank you for the stories, that you told us, that let us know how deep, how all-encompassing, how incredible, how outrageous your love is. Father, help us to change our understanding. It's not about who's right, who's wrong, who's in, who's out. It's about a God who is love, for that's what you tell us, that you are love. Father, I thank you for this church, these incredibly loving people. Very tight-knit community, neat congregation. I thank you for the way that you have blessed them with the leadership they've got, blessed them with the kinds of people you've brought through the doors, kind of church that I'm confident is going to show that love to this neighborhood. Father, may we love well and love always. For this is our prayer, in Christ's name, amen.